Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. With the state's vaccination rate climbing, rules on mask wearing are changing and what that means beginning today and for the coming months. With all the extra work brought on by the pandemic, the CMS proposed budget includes teacher and staff pay raises. A judge in North Carolina orders body cam footage of the death of Andrew Brown Jr. to be disclosed to his family, but not yet to the public. Duke Energy launches a pilot program that will bring electric buses to Charlotte streets next year, and Apple decides to build its first East Coast campus in the Research Triangle. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's David Borax. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Joe Bruno is here after a very long night in Boone last night for WSOC TV Channel 9. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Take the toothpicks out of your eyes now. Katie Peralta Soloff is with us. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Katie, welcome back.
Good morning.
And Glenn Birkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. He joins us again. Thanks, Glenn. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
The number of North Carolinians who are now at least partially vaccinated against COVID is hovering at around 38.5%. And despite some troubling indicators that we are not yet out of the woods, Governor Roy Cooper is, quote, cautiously easing, end quote, some restrictions.
Masks will no longer be required outdoors. And mass gathering limits will increase to 100 people indoors and 200 outdoors. Masks will continue to be required indoors in public places, since this virus still can spread easily when we're inside.
So I guess that's good news if it doesn't result in an increase in infections. Was it expected, or was this a surprise to people that the masks are going away outdoors? Joe.
I think it was expected that the outdoor mask mandate would be lifted given the CDC's new guidance that came a day or two before. I think the surprise came from some people that found out that there was an outdoor mask mandate in place because nobody really wore masks outside. But this will have an impact on, you know, you don't have to feel guilty if you're not wearing a neck gaiter while you're running on the rail trail because you technically don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
Youth sports, this has an impact. They won't have to wear masks while playing. For the fans that are attending, they don't have to feel like they have to wear something while they're watching their kids playing. So minimal impact here, but, it's a step towards normalcy.
You mentioned the CDC guidelines because they've come out and said that people who are fully vaccinated don't need to wear masks outdoors. The governor says, if you're partially vaccinated, you can do it. Why? This is another example of mixed signals. Why the difference?
I mean, they didn't enforce you have to wear a mask outdoors. How would they enforce you can only not wear a mask if you are fully vaccinated? So, we don't know. There haven't been a whole lot of instances where there has been widespread COVID outbreaks due to outdoor gatherings. People will say, what about the Rose Garden? Well, that was inside as well. Or the motorcycle rally in South Dakota. That, again, people flooded bars afterwards. So those events that people think were super spreaders that were outdoors had a lot of indoor components to them. So we don't know a lot about these outdoor mass gathering events. So the risk is very much lower to not wear your mask outside than inside.
So this mandate to wear masks that no one's enforcing end today, this afternoon, Friday afternoon. I assume that it's at 5 o'clock because that's when all the other orders have generally taken effect over the last several months. The governor also announced that when at least 2/3 of adults have been vaccinated with at least one dose, which means about 66% of the population, and if trends remain stable, he plans to lift the mask mandate altogether, meaning indoors. Was he at all specific about what metrics he would be using to make that decision? Because he does allude to trends remaining stable.
Yeah, I mean, he said he wants the trends to remain stable, and he wants that 66.6% of people mm-hmm. have least one dose before he lifts the mask mandate entirely. And the explanation for why 66.6, two-thirds of adults, was basically that they think that North Carolina can live with the virus if we have at least two-thirds of adults vaccinated. And, you know, it's important to know, even in the communities that have, in the states that have lifted their mask mandates, people are still wearing masks by their choice. And I think that we'll still see people wearing masks indoors even after the mask mandate is lifted.
Given our current rate of inoculations, do we have any idea of when the state thinks we might reach that 66.6%?
Right. I was hoping we'd reach it by June 1st, but I don't think we'll get there. We only had a small increase in the amount of people that have been vaccinated from last week until now. People just aren't rushing out to get their shots anymore, so it might be some time.
Katie, interestingly enough, predominantly blue Mecklenburg County is behind the rest of the state in terms of our vaccination rate. I think only 29.6% of our residents have been vaccinated at least once. And statewide, that number is hovering, as I said, near 38.5%. Why the difference? Do we have any idea why?
State and local health officials have given a number of reasons for this. Number one, you are counted in your home county where you get vaccinated. So sometimes if people come here to get vaccinated, they might not count as being vaccinated here. We're also the largest county in the state. So it's going to take a really long time to get everyone who's eligible to get a vaccine, willing to get it. There are still a lot of vaccine hesitant communities around Charlotte and surrounding areas. I mean, we've talked about this multiple times on the program. Young people now are our target group for health officials because so many older groups have been vaccinated. The most vulnerable groups have been vaccinated. So that's why you'll see, you know, vaccination events cropping up at places like breweries these days. I think the thinking is that they want to meet young people where they are. A growing number of colleges like Duke is requiring vaccinations for students to come back to campus. So this is a really, really concerted effort to get everyone who's eligible vaccinated as quickly as possible, because that's the surest way to return to normalcy. So in Mecklenburg County, and to sum it up, it's really multiple factors, but I can safely say it's not by lack of trying by local health officials, I think.
And along with the end of the mask mandate, some other changes are coming. The increase in the size of outdoor gatherings. So what have they been? What will they be beginning at 5 o'clock today?
You know, really, when you hear about that mass gathering limit, you have to keep in mind that's really about private events. It doesn't impact like restaurants or bars or things like that, or stadiums. So if you have a backyard big enough, you can have 200 people in it for your private gathering, or your house, you can have 100 people. So congratulations.
Just in time for graduation parties. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Kitty.
Just in time for wedding season.
Yeah, exactly. Indoor capacity was changed a little bit. I think we're now at 100. Is that right, Joe? And I'm curious as to how that differs from what the governor announced on March 26th.
I believe it was 50 and 100 before, okay. Now 100, 200.
So the pace of vaccinations is beginning to slow here and around the country. Some of the people who are getting the two-shot Moderna and Pfizer vaccine evidently aren't returning for their second shot. And nationwide, more than 5 million people have missed their second dose. Do we have numbers for Charlotte or for North Carolina? And why would you not come back?
Yeah, I don't have specific numbers for Charlotte or North Carolina, but you know, it's maybe people are turned off if they felt a little achy or some chills after their first shot. I think if people kind of just took like an antibody test and saw how, you know, weak their response is after only having one dose compared to what it would be after two, more people would come back to get that second dose, but. People really need to think about this. If they think that getting a second dose is going to be an issue, they should consider getting a Johnson & Johnson so they can be fully protected.
And Mike, there's a lot of chatter about that second dose being a hard hitter. And, that may or may not be true. I think it's different for everyone. But for every 9 people who have little reaction, there's somebody who has, 2 days off from work or something. And so I think people are shying away from that.
I had less of a reaction to the second Pfizer vaccine than I did the first. And the first was only a sore arm for a couple of days. Do we know if these people really aren't returning? Or you know this all too well, Joey, because you've been helping people get appointments to get a vaccine, which initially were very difficult to get. But are perhaps they are getting the second shot, but they're just not going back to the same place they got the first shot. So those people don't know that you've been fully vaccinated. Could that be possible?
I think they still know whether or not they get a second dose, regardless of where they got their first dose from. And, you know, one excuse that might have passed during the a couple months ago was, oh, I traveled 4 hours away to get my first dose. I don't want to go back 4 hours again to get the second. But now everyone can just go to StarMed or StarMed's airport clinic at the Sheraton Hotel and get a second dose, regardless of where you got your first. So that excuse just doesn't pass anymore.
Well, and Novant recently, I think this week, opened up some remote vaccination locations at retail stores under tents in parking lots. So is it safe to say, Joe, that if you want a shot, it's easy now to get one? Can you just walk in?
Yeah. You can get it anywhere you want, basically. If you want to get a shot at CVS, there's an appointment tomorrow for you.
Okay.
And Mike, one note about the people's willingness to get the vaccine. We had some news this week from Rowan County, northeast of Charlotte, where they have stopped doing their mass vaccination clinics because demand had fallen so low that they weren't getting a big turnout. You can still get a vaccine there, but they're just not doing the big clinics anymore.
On the heels of the conviction of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for murdering George Floyd, we have yet another incident where a black man is shot and killed by police, this time in Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice!
Protesters during a second week of protests in that coastal community over the death of Andrew Brown Jr. as sheriff's deputies were attempting to serve a search warrant. A lot of that tension is the result of police body and dash cam footage not being released. But before we talk about that, remind us of the circumstances of Mr. Brown's death.
Well, we don't know a lot about it because we've not seen the video. We have conflicting reports, actually. Sheriff's deputies or the sheriff has said that as deputies were attempting to arrest Mr. Brown, that he attempted to drive off and made contact with officers. Some who have seen snippets of the body cam footage dispute that. We do know that the fatal shot was to the back of his head. He was struck multiple times, but the fatal shot was to the back of his head. And so people are eager to see the footage so they can determine for themselves.
And there has also been, I think, surveillance footage from a nearby home's surveillance camera that shows police converging on Mr. Brown's location. It's hard to say exactly where that location is, but they're coming barreling down the street and they turn a corner and it's in an open vehicle. And I think it's an open vehicle and everybody jumps out. It looks like the Wild West somewhat. In North
That's
Carolina.
That's actually making the rounds on social media. If you've seen it, there's a screenshot from that video that shows this pickup truck with, you know, five or six people in the back of it going around the corner. And, you know, as somebody in one post that I read said, it looks like a dictatorship country where they're going to make an arrest of a political person or something.
A lot more to talk about, particularly with regard to the laws that govern the release of body cam footage in North Carolina, which seem to be playing a significant role in the unrest down there in Elizabeth City and just the raising of tensions. We'll do that when we get back. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're joined by David Borax from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Katie Peralta-Soloff, reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Joe Bruno with WSOC-TV. In North Carolina, as we've said, police body cam and dash cam footage can only be released on the order of a judge. And this week, a judge made a ruling. But prior to that, the Pasquotank County Sheriff allowed the family to see 20 seconds of footage. A lot has been made of the family only being allowed to see 20 seconds of the footage. Why such a short clip? And do we know what part of the footage they got to see? Glenn or David?
I don't know what part of the footage they got to see, or for that matter, why so little of the footage. Lawyers representing the family did later say that based on what they saw, they called it an execution. So I'm assuming that they did see perhaps the most critical part, but maybe not what led up to it or as much as they wanted to see.
That lawyer's
name is... There are four body cam videos and at least one dashboard cam video that we're waiting for. So that's, you know, 20 seconds is such a tiny piece of that. I think that's what's driving a lot of the concern.
Right. That lawyer that you alluded to there, Glenn, is Chantel Cherry Lassiter, one of the attorneys for the Brown family. She, along with the family, saw the clip. And as you said, this is how she described what she saw.
Let's be clear. This was an execution.
Another attorney for the family, Harris Kendall, said that an independent autopsy concluded that Brown was shot five times with a fatal shot to the head as he was driving, driving away from deputies.
They put a bullet in back of his head, in the back of his head. A black man, unarmed, bullet in back of his head.
So this week, a judge ordered the family, a disclosure to the family of the remaining footage, I believe, from all five body cams and the police dash cam, but only the family. And they will have 10 days, the officials will have 10 days with which to comply with that order, but it will be at least 30 to 45 days before the public, including the media, will get to have a glimpse of this footage. Why do they need so much time?
Well, the judge said that the media lacks standing to seek the video. And the judge also said that a good cause does not exist to make the video public at this time. Attorneys have indicated that they will appeal that decision, but particularly the part where the media does not have standing to seek the video, that is new. And I don't understand that at all.
Charlotte media law attorney Jonathan Buchan, who in full disclosure used to be on the board here at WFAE, says that statute is very specific about who can request that video. It reads, any person requesting release of a recording may file an action in the Superior Court seeking release. And he says the judge's ruling is flat wrong and erroneous. So I take it the media will appeal.
That's what attorneys have indicated that they will appeal, yes.
And one would think...
Just to give you an idea about this, Mike, there have been, since 2019, there have been 475 police videos that have come up like this, and only seven times in a year and a half have judges refused to release it right away. So this is an unusual situation.
On the one hand, I think the judge may... have some problem with finding good cause to release it in that it might subdue some of the tension out there. Of course, it could also increase the tension if depending upon what we see. And citizens and a lot of media organizations have been requesting, as we said, the release of this footage. Andrew Womble, the Pasquotank district attorney, has said releasing the body cam footage would hinder his investigation and if charges are filed would taint a future jury.
What I do know is that you cannot swing a skunk in front of a group of people and then ask them not to smell it.
So Womble, the district attorney, also takes issue with the Chantel Cherry Lassiter, the family's lawyer's description of what happened. He claims, and I think you mentioned this, Glenn, that the car, Brown's car, was stationary when the deputies approached him and shouted commands, and then the car moved backward. It made contact with some of the deputies. It stopped, and then it moved forward and again made contact with some of the deputies. And Womble says it is then and only then that you hear shots. Sometimes body camera and dash cam footage is not as clear as you would hope it would be and does not necessarily help all that much in determining precisely what happened. But if this footage does substantiate Womble's claim, and the judge has said that it does show the moment that the sheriff's officers fired at Andrew Brown, wouldn't release of the video calm the situation?
It's hard to know. A video, as you said, it can be subjective. When we talk about making contact with, that still doesn't necessarily mean that fatal force was required. We've seen these shootings in the past where officers have alleged that a suspect who was driving made contact. That has not always been the case. We have to wait and see. And that's part of the problem. No one knows. No one knows except those who have seen the video.
And body cam footage is not a Hollywood shoot. It is not they're not steady cams. They're moving all over the place. They're not necessarily focused on the action that you'd hope they'd be focused on, because it's not premeditated. It is all spur of the moment. It's very rare that we have a situation like we had in George Floyd's case, where we had 13 bystanders with camera phones all filming what was essentially a stationary 9.5 minutes. That's very rare. Q-City Metro Glenn reports that Reverend William Barber has called the district attorney's handling of this case inept and a moral failure. How so?
Well, he was talking about the handling of that case, but he and other clergy from that area met with the family to declare a moral emergency, not just there, but nationwide in the wake of the spate of police shootings. I think he's alluding to what we're talking about, the hesitancy to release the body camera video, but not just that, but just the entire history of policing in the Black communities.
And William Barber has called, he said this about this case: a warrant is not a license to kill. And, you know, obvious point, but this was serving a warrant for some drug-related charges. They brought this large number of officers there. They were all armed and ready for war. And, that's his complaint there.
Keith Rivers, who is president of the Pasquotank County chapter of the NAACP, says they, along with other groups, including Black Voters Matter, are seeking to flex economic clout to achieve justice for the Brown family. What is their plan? Do we know yet?
Well, we know that they have, I won't necessarily call it a boycott, but they have targeted some businesses in the area twice a day, earlier this week and last week. They were blocking the bridge that goes to the Outer Banks. They were just trying to, kind of target the economic underpinnings of the community to bring additional pressure to bear to get those body cam videos released.
The governor has called for a special prosecutor in this case. Does he have the power just to make that happen, or does it have to go through the attorney general or through the legislature or some other North Carolina authority before that can happen? Do we know?
I believe that would be a Department of Justice, State Department of Justice call on that one. Also, the feds are talking about doing an investigation as well.
They're launching a civil rights probe to determine whether federal laws were violated in this incident. How unusual is it for the federal government to get involved in a local shooting like this?
You know, we haven't seen much of that for the past 4 years, but it's increasingly common now for the federal government to start getting involved in these local cases, not just on these police killings of people of color, but also broader investigations of police departments.
It's not as unusual as you might think. I can think of several high profile police shootings where the federal government did get involved, and usually found that the police acted within their authority.
Are we to assume that the federal laws that they're going to determine were violated or not would be civil rights laws?
Absolutely. Okay.
Andrew Brown's funeral will be held next Monday in Elizabeth City, and Reverend Al Sharpton, who's become the go-to minister in these cases, will deliver the eulogy. And on Wednesday of this week, two deputies were killed and three other people, including the suspected gunman, were found dead after a 13-hour standoff in Boone. You were there for a long time yesterday and into the night last night, Joe Bruno. Tell us what you know.
So this was a shooting involving a person went to his parents' home. It was a mom, husband and wife, and their stepson and son. And while he was there, deputies came and they served a welfare check. And the person inside ended up shooting the two deputies. We later found out that he also killed his parents as well. For a while, we did not know the condition of one of the deputies because they were inside with the suspect there. The other was flown to Johnson City and pronounced dead at the hospital. And a 13-hour standoff ensued. At one point, a Boone police officer responding to the scene was shot at by the suspect, but the bullet hit the officer's helmet and the officer was unharmed in the incident. A 13-hour standoff eventually came to the end when Isaac Barnes, the shooter in this case, died by suicide.
Let's go over some city-county odds and ends, beginning with police reform. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings says the conviction of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis for the murder of George Floyd could help rebuild trust between the public and police, but he quickly added that the current level of distrust between the public and police nationally, especially in the African-American community, is the highest he has ever seen. So he is proposing something that has been described as radically new. He wants CMPD officers to begin treating the people with whom they interact as customers. Has this ever been tried before anywhere?
The group that the city has hired here, CMPD has hired for $60,000, is the Julius Group. And they have never worked with a police department on this customer service training. They have worked with like companies like Disney, Nordstrom, and Starbucks, but never a police department. So this is a new approach.
And that has Julian Ortiz, who's a spokesperson for the Charlotte Fraternal Order of Police, less than thrilled, shall we say. This is what she told WSOC-TV.
Unfortunately, we feel like we are kind of just left aside or an afterthought.
You mentioned, Joe, that the CMPD is paying this company, outside company, $60,000, and she says that's money misspent. She says if the focus was on boosting officer morale, if police officers felt that they were heard and taken care of, police behavior would naturally improve. Really? That's the problem? Low morale?
There are numerous issues that Chief Jennings is dealing with right now. I would say that there's a lack of trust in the community, and there might be a lack of trust or a lack of morale in his department. And the FOP feels that they should have been brought into this conversation sooner, and they were kind of just pushed aside. And this outside consultant that has never worked with a police department before is coming in to train them on customer service. And there are a lot of questions about what does that mean? How does that apply to police and their everyday lives?
You have to wonder how that phrase, the customer is always right, will play out in this situation.
Well, that's where I was going. We've all heard that phrase. And if you've ever worked in retail, the customer is always right if you want to keep that customer happy and keep that customer coming back. But the whole point of policing is you don't want to keep that customer coming back. And sometimes, as she points out, the customer isn't always right. So is it reasonable to expect officers to treat suspects who they are trying to apprehend or handcuff or stuff in the back of a police car as customers?
You know, Mike, there are some problems with that. But I've got to go back to that point about low police morale being the problem. That's just ridiculous. Black communities have been targeted by police since the founding of this nation. whether we've been talking about runaway slaves or people simply marching across a bridge for civil rights, or now what we're seeing. This is not anything new. It's part of American history, and to imply that it's because that the police are somehow victims, that's ridiculous. Now, going back to this customer model that the chief of police is talking about, I think you raised some valid points. The customer is not always right. There are times when police have to do police work, and we'll see how that plays out. I think we should all give the chief an opportunity and see how this works. But the problems are much bigger. The problems are, as he said before, on the day that verdict came down, police officers are still people, and they do things that can't be taken back. And they bring to that job all the prejudices, all the biases that they have in their everyday walks of life.
Would a better word have been used would it have been respect? Treat the suspect with respect. I don't know if you can do that in all situations, but would that have been a better word or a better approach?
I'll let the chief decide which word he wants to use.
Okay. Charlotte City Council signing off on spending $25.9 million from the Housing Trust Fund for 14 affordable housing projects. Where are these scheduled to be built?
Well, they are spread out in almost all areas of the city, and not all 14 will be built because several of them are seeking competitive state tax credits. But the areas the units will not be in are District 6 and 7, and some Charlotte City Council members were not happy about that fact.
Because it's not going to be equal in all areas, I take it. These newly constructed units would be earmarked for households earning 30% of the area median income, and 7 of the projects, as you mentioned, Joe, are pursuing the 9% low-income housing tax credit administered through the state. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that and about homelessness and other actions taken on this week by the City Council, and get to the education budget, which has been increased substantially here this year, or at least the request has, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. And Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Mike Collins, it's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Glenn Berkson from QCityMetro.com. Katie Peralta Sola from Axios Charlotte. And Joe Bruno from WSOC TV Channel 9. City leaders also announced efforts this week to wipe out homelessness and further expand affordable housing within 5 years. This has happened before, but David, you report that this time some believe it has a better chance of succeeding. Why?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify that this is not a plan yet. This is a plan to do a plan by October of this year. And the idea is to try and eliminate or at least make a huge dent in homelessness here in Charlotte. What's different about this one is the broad coalition of people that have been brought together here. One of the problems that people see is that we have the county spending money on homelessness, we have the city spending it, we have multiple nonprofit organizations spending money, and they don't always talk to each other in the way that some people think they should. And so the idea here is to get everybody at the table, and they really have tried to do that. I mean, every major housing organization, homelessness services group in Charlotte is included here. There are even folks who have been or are experiencing homelessness will be on this group that's hammering this out. I talked to Dina DiOrio, the county manager, and she says that having all those people in the same place will get people talking to each other. And she hopes that this will be entirely about execution of a plan, not talking about what we're going to do. I also talked to Malcolm Graham this week, same thing. He says, we can't just keep talking about this and keep coming up with studies. We need to actually make this happen. And he feels like with all of these people at the table, it will make a huge difference.
Do any of these studies ever point back or ever describe what the root of this problem is?
You know, they always talk about it. I think when you're trying to solve it, it always comes down to one question. How do we improve the housing supply and improve the ability of people to find housing? And one big difference this time as well, I think it's the other major thing that people are pointing to, is that at this moment in time, because of the pandemic, we have a massive infusion of money. The county is in line to get something like $215 million from the American Rescue Plan Act that was passed earlier. The city will get $149 million, and they can and probably will put a large portion of that towards things like buying hotels, which is another opportunity that we have at this moment. If you think about it, nobody's staying in hotels. The hotel business is in the dumps. It is a moment when things can happen. So,
the other thing that I would add to that, Mike, is I don't think there is any one root cause. As you know, there are mental illness is certainly a problem. Substance abuse is certainly a problem. But one other problem is just economic hard times. Sometimes people just lose a job. They fall on hard times and they can't afford to keep their house. They can't afford to make the rent payment. And suddenly they find themselves homeless or living in a shelter. And one of the things that they're going to try to do with this strategy is to come up with strategies to address those people as well, so that people are not losing their homes when they are when they hit an economic hard time.
The idea, we're going to switch subjects here now rather dramatically. The idea of electric vehicles just a few years ago, a year and a half, 2 years ago, seemed ludicrous on the face of it. And now suddenly every car manufacturer in the world, it seems, minus Toyota, is in the works of trying to put on the streets electric vehicles. And I think Cadillac has promised to go all electric with their fleet in a few short years. And now Charlotte City Council has given the green light to buy 18 electric buses and put them on the streets by 2022, which is, by my count, next year. It is a 12 to 18 month pilot program in cooperation, I'm told, with Duke Energy. What is Duke Energy's role in this, David?
Duke is really the middleman here. It's the consultant to the city, helping them to line up this trial run of three different brands of buses over the next 18 months or so. They are also consulting on and providing help with the infrastructure that's needed around this, mainly the charging stations that will be needed. And, you know, I think Duke sees this as a new business that it can get into as we electrify our vehicle fleet around the country.
So the city council approved $23 million for the purchase of these buses, and there is a plan to transition the entire fleet of buses within 10 years. It sounds like that they have made a commitment. So what is the 12 to 18 month pilot program about?
They are testing this with different manufacturers to kind of get a feel for what works best, because the city's entire bus fleet is, I believe, 300 vehicles. Mm-hmm. So they're testing it with an initial 18 with different manufacturers to see what works best, because it is a significant undertaking that is very, very expensive.
Yeah.
David. It should be noted as well that part of President Biden's infrastructure plan, if it gets passed, would put charging stations, all over the country. So, you know, this is a move. This is a direction where it appears that there's some momentum there.
Yep.
David? And the city has climate goals that it's trying to reach, getting to zero emissions by 2050 and really reducing things by 2030. I talked to Shannon Binns of Sustain Charlotte, and he's been pushing for electric buses for years. He's happy about this development, but he also says that we need a lot more money in order to actually get all 300 buses switched over.
Yeah, the initial cost is enormous, but I will bet you that the savings on oil and diesel and other elements that go into
combustion engines year
is a lot of money. It's been a tough year for educators at all levels, with teachers being asked to do much more than they normally would because of the pandemic. That figured into the budget that CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston presented this week to the school board.
The budget that we have discussed to this point, and that we present tonight for your consideration, has been created with the impact of the pandemic, both front and center.
So what's he recommending?
So he's recommending a budget of $551 million, which is $26.5 million more for this year. It includes 29 new social workers, 10 more psychologists, 3% raises for all staff. It's a lot more. There's also another element here, which is that there's a huge chunk of federal money coming into the city and to CMS. And some people are asking, well, why can't we just use that? But that money is really, it comes with a lot of strings attached. Some of it is really intended to be one-time expenses, not the operating budget that this is talking about.
Well, this has to go to the county, I take it. So what are the chances? I know this is round one. What are the chances that this will survive even remotely intact?
You know, we'll see. The county and CMS, as you know, mix about as well as Fireball and olive oil, but it's an interesting year, and I'm sure the county will hear them out.
Okay, here's an unusual question for the panel. What is this sound?
It's what's about to happen to my computer. It's going to have to reboot.
That's right. That's the Apple startup sound, but it's also the sound of North Carolina landing a major corporate deal. Apple is finally arriving. They've decided to locate their first East Coast campus in the Research Triangle. What? Not here? Why?
I think that was the question that everybody in Charlotte asked after this major announcement earlier this week in the Triangle. North Carolina, specifically the Triangle, has been courting Apple for like 3 years for this project. Apple initially chose Austin, Texas for this other campus that's like, you know, they're investing $1 billion in. It'll have, you know, thousands of jobs ultimately. That campus is still happening. But they also decided to move forward with their first major East Coast campus in the Triangle. This is the biggest jobs announcement in North Carolina history. It will employ, I believe, upwards of 3,000 people. It is a major, major investment. It's also huge for the entire state of North Carolina. I think a few people interviewed economist Michael Walden, who said that the multiplying jobs effect is significant in North Carolina because a lot of other tech companies.
That's okay. It's all right. Here is precisely what he said.
The thing to keep in mind here, when Apple announces a job number, you can usually double that when you take into account all the other firms that are going to come here because Apple comes.
So you mentioned 3,000 jobs from Apple in their 1 million square foot building and a $1 billion investment into North Carolina. So how many more jobs could result from Apple deciding to be here, and when might they arrive?
Well, here's the thing. That's technically, I guess, the theoretical, right? So he's saying that basically the larger and stronger our tech ecosystem is, the larger and stronger it will be for all of North Carolina. In the Triangle, they already have Red Hat, IBM, Lenovo, Oracle, Cisco, all of these giant tech employers that are building off the tech base that's there. And, you know, gradually in Charlotte, we're starting to see some of that too with a lot of fintech specifically. But it's, you know, that having the workforce here and building off that workforce and sharing that workforce is something that's really, really valuable to companies. So I think that Dr. Walden is spot on when he says that the fact that this will multiply the number of related engineering and software jobs in the area is certainly something that we can expect.
And these are jobs that's the minimum starting salary is $133,520. Up to $168,000, which triples the current average annual wage in Wake County. And you mentioned all these other tech companies that are in the Research Triangle area, IBM, Red Hat, Lenovo, Cree, Oracle, Cisco, plus Google is planning a new engineering hub in Durham, and Microsoft is adding hundreds of jobs in the Triangle. As you said, Katie, Charlotte has been trying to compete and become a tech hub. Are we kidding ourselves?
No. Last year, we had the biggest jobs announcement in state history with Centene announcing its major tech campus in the university area. Lowe's is building a gigantic skyscraper in Southend for its tech hub. I mean, these things are spread out. It's okay if the Triangle gets to feel some of the love every now and then. I think that Charlotte's reaped plenty of benefits, and it's, you know, it's a win for North Carolina as a whole. And I think that we have a chip on our shoulder when it comes to economic development announcements like this.
Okay. Despite problems with collecting census data, and they were no secret over the last year or so during this pandemic, the count is beginning to trickle out. And this week we got our first look at states gaining and states losing seats in Congress. North Carolina will gain an additional seat over the next 10 years because of our steady growth. And evidently the population distribution data for redistricting will not come out till late summer, early fall, which is why the local elections were postponed, because we can't draw districts yet. So we don't know.
Actually, they may not be postponed in many places. Oh. It's going to be that the legislature has decided not to take any action on this, which means that especially in places where they have non-district elections, at-large elections, they will not be delaying them. Charlotte is looking at what it can do. So.
Okay. But do we have yet any inkling of how this new 14th congressional district might be drawn, where it will be, who it might impact?
So that's a million-dollar question. It seems likely that it will be drawn in an urban area, so maybe one of the big metro areas in North Carolina, but we just don't know yet. So it'll be up to whoever draws that when the legislature gets around to that. So,
and Catawba College political scientist Michael Bitzer told ABC 11 in Raleigh that we can probably predict which way this district will lean.
The Republicans have the control. They will determine where that 14th seat will be. It will be beneficial to them and to their incumbents.
So no surprise there. And Dr. Michael Bitzer will be talking about this in some detail coming up on Monday on this program, as he talks about the 2020 census and the political ramifications of it. Meanwhile, the number of candidates filing to run in the race to replace incumbent Republican Senator Richard Burr continues to grow. We have members of both parties who added their names to this growing list this week. Let's start on the Republican side. Who joined?
Congressman Ted Budd of the 13th District.
Big supporter of President Trump.
Yes, and he is angling to be the conservative candidate. It has already appeared that, you know, Walker and Budd are kind of, you know, battling each other for that conservative lane, and they're trying to make Pat McCrory appear to be the establishment pick.
And the liberal. Yes. And on the Democratic side, we already have State Senator Jeff Jackson in the race, and another top Democrat also just joined that contest, former State Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, Sherry Beasley. People don't often know much about judges. Who is she?
She is the former Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. She ran a very competitive race against Paul Newby and came within about 500, 600, 400 votes. So very competitive statewide race. We'll see what her political beliefs are. Senate race is certainly much different than a Supreme Court Chief Justice race, but it will be an interesting addition.
It seems that Republicans have a slight edge at this point in time in terms of name recognition factor of some of their leading candidates on the Republican side. They seem to have more statewide recognition than the Democrats. Democrats have also had difficulty in recent federal elections in North Carolina, and this race could decide control of the United States Senate in 2 years. What do Democrats have to do to win, and will we see a ton of money being flooded into the state because of this, the stakes here?
Quickly. Number one, they have to raise a ton of money, Mike. Absolutely. I mean, Jeff Jackson, the state senator from Charlotte, is leading the fundraising right now. I think he raised more than like $1.3 million from January until the middle of this month. So.
And finally, Hester McArdle Ford died this week. She was a Charlottean. She was 115 or 116 years old, America's oldest living person. She will have her graveside service today at noon, and on Wednesday of this past week, Duke Energy Center uptown was lit up in purple, her favorite color. Thanks to David Borax, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Katie Peralta Solov from Axios Charlotte, and Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Thanks all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.